Hello, welcome to the Longshot Leaders Podcast. I'm Michael Stein. My guest today is Eric Ressler. Eric is the founder of Cosmic, a social impact creative agency. We're going to get into how to advertise your business, but also what he does and how he came about to do it. Really interesting person. Thought it'd be a nice way to start off the year to figuring out how you can promote your business, promote yourself, and also just find out a little more about this guy. Pretty interesting. Here is Eric Ressler. All right, I'm here with Eric Ressler. We're talking to the pregame. He's a California boy like me. He says he doesn't have a long shot story. That's what we call it. You know, it doesn't matter. We're going to get into some skill set today too later on. I want to do the cursory origin story. We want to get into branding. It's a new year. We're going to be launching something. A lot of people want to launch something. I want to get into all that. But I want to go back to when you're surfing, when you started surfing. You grew up in California like me. I body surfed and boogie boarded. I'm from Encino. You were Laguna, right? That's where you were born?
Redondo. So I also grew up bodyboarding. Good bodyboarding wave.
Okay. Yeah. So now, what did your mom and dad do for a living? Because I want to know what kind of built you.
So they were both basically in sales for tech pretty early on, before that was a common thing. So worked for DEC, worked for IBM, worked for Xerox. And so I actually was really lucky growing up to have a computer in the house before a lot of my friends did, getting on the internet pretty early. My mom's dad was actually really techie and he liked to tinker just like I do. So he actually had, I think like dial up or 56K, whatever happened first with the internet before even we did in our house. I thought it was the coolest thing, being able to go on and download something from the internet. It was such a novel thing at the time. Now it's something we do, you know, every single day on our phones without thinking about it.
Brothers and sisters, just you? What else?
One younger brother. Yeah.
Oh, you're the oldest. So you're a little bit more of the responsible one?
Usually.
Okay. Yeah, usually. But okay. So high school, are you surfing? What's high school like for you?
A lot of music in high school, actually. So grew up surfing younger, I don't know if everyone in California, there's a program called junior lifeguards where you get trained up to really understand how the ocean works, which I think is really important if you live by the ocean. And so did that in kind of pre-high school. High school, got into, you know, some track, cross country, a little bit of tennis, but really kind of stopped doing sports so much, still surfing and all that, but really got into music pretty heavily, which is something still, you know, near and dear to my heart today, more so than ever, actually. So played in bands, played with friends, and really started to kind of explore that side of creativity as well.
Cool. College, you go to college?
I did. I went to college for about a year before dropping out and then starting doing some freelance design work.
And how did you start to segue into what do you do now? So you're doing design work. What do you do after that? How do you get into this and in being a branding aficionado?
So I still consider our shop to be a design shop at the end of the day. I think that is kind of the ethos behind how we do everything with branding and marketing and technology and all these things that are essentially synonymous with design in 2023. But to rewind, like, how did I get into it? We talked about this briefly already, but have always been curious. I've always been a tinkerer. I've been a kind of creative type since a young age. So what that looked like when I was 10, 11, 12 was making stop motion animation videos with Legos with the webcam that was on the old, you know, box Mac, one of the first personal computers, through, you know, getting into doing some photography and some video work, some fine art stuff. But, you know, honestly, when I could combine the creativity with the computer, where I could make things perfect, where the way I saw them in my head, but could never do on pen and paper, that's what really kind of clicked for me. So then started to get kind of into digital media and design, even like building out web pages for bands I was in high school and kind of learning how to code, learning how to do branding, website stuff. And so that kind of started pretty early. And then I went to school for design at SDSU in their design program, which was at the time, and maybe still is, I honestly don't keep track, one of the better graphic design programs within the kind of 4-year model. There were always, you know, art schools like Otis and RISD and whatnot. But within like a traditional university setting, they're one of the first schools to have a proper graphic design program. And, you know, it was fine. There were things that kind of clicked for me and things that didn't. Frankly, I'm not a very structured learner. I learn better by doing and failing and iterating. And so kind of the traditional academic environment doesn't work very well for my brain, which is one of the reasons I kind of stopped. I was just like, this isn't helping me. It's not my path. And so just kind of stopped. I was already freelancing while in school. So I was like, you know, I think I can make a go of this. So kind of moved back from San Diego to LA and started doing freelancing. And then that took off, you know, pretty quickly. When you're first cutting your teeth, you got to kind of just take what comes to you. And, you know, honestly, I think that's the way, because you get a broad set of experiences quickly and, you know, you learn from your mistakes quickly, you know, literally answering Craigslist ads for building out websites. Right. Yeah. And, but it was enough to allow me to kind of, I knew I wanted to get out of LA and just experience something new. So I moved up to where I am right now, actually in Santa Cruz, just south of San Francisco. And so that's really kind of the path from, you know, early childhood to kind of the beginning of a professional career.
So what is your business, the journey of your business look like when you move up to Santa Cruz? Obviously you've grown this business and it was Cosmic. It's called Cosmic.
Yep.
And sounds like it's grown pretty well, you know, knock on wood, right? A little bit of that. Now, what are some of the big needle movers for you and how has grown since you started it?
Yeah. So, you know, honestly, getting into doing freelance work early on, even before Cosmic, just born out of the need to pay the bills, right? Like, hey, I got to make ends meet. You know, I want to make a go of this. This is a marketable skill. I'm good at it. I enjoy it. I'm still learning. I'm still early in the career, but, you know, let's do this, right? So that's kind of how it started. I did some work on my own. I did some work with a friend and kind of started a different company that lasted a couple of years before it, you know, wasn't really working anymore. So I kind of felt like it was time for me to kind of go out on my own again and start over. And, you know, at the time I was living with some friends, close friends of mine. I was in a band with them doing that, you know, semi-professionally as well. But, you know, being in a band is a tough gig to try and make ends meet, even if, you know, we were starting to see some traction, but it doesn't pay the bills so well until you really start to get to a big level. So I kept the design business going, doing that freelance, but it was like all my friends that I was living with working restaurant gigs, I'm trying to work in the middle of the day. They're trying to get me to go surf, go to the gym, whatever. Like, I got to get out of here. I can't do this. So I went downtown to Santa Cruz and saw a co-working space at the time that's still there called Next Space that was basically, you know, a place where I could have a small desk and, you know, be uninterrupted and go and work. And that was huge because it was a great hub of networking. This was 2009, like right after the crash, and everyone was trying to figure out what was next for them, starting new stuff, which is a great place to be if you're a designer and everyone needs branding work, everyone needs website work. And that was really, you know, it's one of those things where I went there not to network, but because I just needed a place to be and to work. And it ended up being a really great place to meet some colleagues who still work with me today, as well as a bunch of early clients that allowed me to kind of get a foundation going to the business.
Did you get any spillover from like, San Jose and the Silicon Valley, those guys wanting to work with you a little bit down in Santa Cruz?
A ton. Yeah. I mean, Santa Cruz is technically not part of the Bay Area or Silicon Valley. We get lumped more into Monterey Bay, but there's a ton of folks here who work in Silicon Valley, San Jose, all the way up to San Francisco. So there's a lot of, and there's a lot of innovation and startups in Santa Cruz too. So there's a lot of spillover in with regards to tech and design. So especially early on, we did a lot of that work, startup work, B2B work, B2C work, and did that for about 7 years, really. We'll be 13 this year as an agency. And so after about that 7 year mark, we got a lot of good work under our belt. We were a pretty sustainable business, but we kind of knew we couldn't just keep, we were starting to cap out a little bit. It's like, okay, what's our stake in the ground going to be? What's our niche going to be? And that's where we kind of made the pivot into social impact. We'd done some work with nonprofits, social enterprises, some funders in the space, but, you know, just alongside our other work, and we really enjoyed it, but it wasn't ever our intention to really deeply become experts at that work. But we knew we needed to find a niche. So when we looked at our portfolio, we're like, okay, what is it that we can really own and kind of differentiate around? And we kept coming up with different ways of essentially describing that sector. And so we, you know, made the pivot again about 7 years ago and started to learn and started to really focus on prioritizing those clients, putting out messaging around trying to attract those types of organizations. And we've been committed to that sector ever since.
Let's go over like a quintessential scenario of a particular company that has, that they want to create a social impact. You know, does that basically mean, you know, they give 1% of their,
you know, a product or revenue towards, you know, tell us a little about it and a perfect, you know, example.
There's a bunch of different ways it shows up. And I think one of the interesting things about the sector is that it's changing a lot. I think traditionally when you would think about social impact, you might think about charities, right? And nonprofits. And of course, they're still really integral into this space. But the way that we really think about it is, does the organization exist to move humanity forward in an authentic way? And that can look like a nonprofit organization, you know, everything from your local food bank to, you know, a nonprofit that is more systemic in nature, that's doing work way up the upstream, so to speak. But it's also more and more looking like traditional businesses or B Corps or social enterprises, really trying to figure out how can they create a positive social impact with a market-based approach. So, you know, classic examples of this would be like Tom's or Patagonia or some of these organizations that still sell goods to make a profit. And that's how they fund the work that they do. But their motivations are not just to sell as much stuff as possible. I think where it gets to become a little bit of a slippery slope is that more and more consumers are really trying to support brands that they believe in, that they feel like are socially responsible, environmentally responsible and sustainable, that aren't exploiting people. And so there's this market drive to support companies like that. And every brand in the world is trying to figure out how to not miss out on that market share. What that means is there's a lot of good coming from that because it's forcing organizations to look at all of those things. Their, you know, their social footprint, their footprint from a climate perspective, you know, how are they treating their workforce? Are they paying living wages? All that kind of stuff. That's the good side of it. The bad side of it is there's a lot of cause marketing happening and everyone is trying to find some kind of purpose-driven approach. They're coming out with campaigns talking about, you know, their impact and how they're doing good. And a lot of times, you know, frankly, it's BS, right? It's like they're using it as a marketing ploy. And at the same time, they're wrecking the world in some other part of the business. So, you know, not to try and hold organizations to some kind of purity test, because I think it's really hard, especially for large corporations that have thousands of workers, many offices. They're, you know, tapped into the global supply chain that's inequitable in a lot of ways. It's not something you can change overnight. But when you see organizations like ExxonMobil putting out, you know, climate campaigns, you also have to pause and say, wait a second, is this legit? And I think as consumers, we're getting really good at sniffing out what's true and what's not through, you know, past the marketing and into the actual actions that organizations take. So, you know, what does a perfect example look like? To us, it looks like an organization that gives a shit and actually comes through on their commitment to social impact from start to finish, not just in terms of what they're doing out in the world, but how they treat their own people. If they're sourcing goods and products, are they doing that sustainably? And again, not in a purity test way, because sometimes, you know, it's hard to be perfect and no one's perfect, right? But are you authentically working towards that? And are you holding the positive impact to the same degree as your goals around profit and other kind of more traditional business metrics that you're looking at?
How effective is it right now? You know, because that's been going on for, you know, about, I don't know, 10 years now, right? To where it's really kind of grown a lot, to where consciousness level of the consumer wants to, you know more about the company and what type of philanthropic, you know, undertones they have or whatever. So do you see some of that now not becoming a factor or it as much? Or how is it shifting? What's that look like now that, you know, it's because it's become very common. You know, it's now you think of a brand, it's like, well, what cause are you going to contribute to now that you want to build a full scope brand? You know, I have a friend has an alcohol company and he gives a percentage of that company to, you know, wildlife, to like rhinos and big cats. You know, each alcohol, there's a men are for his and hers and the women are Pink Kitty and the men's are Easy Rhino. So that, you know, so that's, you know, part of the whole package now. What kind of changes have you seen? Where do you think it's going? What are some of the, you know, the dynamics of it?
So I think 10 years ago, if you came out with this kind of, let's just call it a social enterprise model, it used to be a very distinct differentiator. Not a lot of people were doing that. It was kind of a novel way to set up a business. That's becoming less and less true because of the, you know, factors that we just discussed. So I don't think that means that it's going away. I think it just means that it's not so much a differentiator anymore as it is just an integral pillar to how you run a business. And so, and I think that that's good. I think one thing though, that I would kind of caution, let's say someone who's thinking about starting a business is, yes, build it into your business model. If there is a logical, effective, sustainable way to do that, I think that's great. But like, get your own house in order before you do that, right? So look at, you know, before you're giving back a percentage profit, are you treating your folks well that are helping you build the business? Are you paying them a living wage? Are you being sustainable in the, you know, your supply chain, like whatever it is, right? So your biggest impact, especially as a small company, is going to be the choices that you make every day and how you run your business and treat your team and the products that you put out. Now, it's not to discourage people from creating, you know, what we would call a social enterprise or a B Corp. It's just that, and to speak to B Corp briefly, like largely what they're doing with their certification is kind of creating some standards around what it means to be a B Corp across a number of different elements, such as, you know, pay, sustainability from an economical standpoint, as well as an environmental standpoint, and, you know, giving organizations a score that, and a threshold that they have to reach in order to be considered a B Corp. You know, the B Corp certification is run by a nonprofit. So it's, you know, it's not a government certification. So, you know, they're very transparent around their scoring system and how it works. And each year, if you're a B Corp, you get rescored. And I believe they even want you to kind of improve your score each year to be able to maintain the certification. So I think that's a great model, similar to how we've had certifications for other things like organic or, you know, whatever it is, so that it takes it away a little bit from being so subjective and open to being manipulated and used inauthentically. So, you know, that to my mind is a great idea. But to answer your original question, you know, how can someone who's starting a business kind of use this to their advantage or do it in an authentic way? Again, get your own house in order first. And also think about, you know, based on your unique product or skill set or approach, you know, what do you have to offer? To use Patagonia as an example, their impact and their activism even, which goes, you know, pretty deeply into their business these days, there's a logical line between what they say and what they do that makes sense for their audience and for their products. They're out there working on conservation, environmental activism, because their audience and their customers care about those things. And they create clothing and apparel that helps people who care about those things live that lifestyle and that life. And I think that that really helps a lot if you're thinking about some kind of social impact angle, is that it has some kind of logical element and connection and thread between the kind of core work that your organization does and the impact that it can have, versus something that feels kind of just out of left field, you know, like, why are they supporting this thing when they do this, right? And, you know, again, that approach could work for some folks too. I don't know that it needs to be a purity test, but as long as it's authentic and there's some kind of authentic thread, and that it's not something that's just being thought of as a marketing ploy, but is actually an important integral part of how you run the business, I think that's the way to go.
Do you see that as being a big mover for Patagonia, them promoting that? And that really, I mean, I know that it's there's philanthropic, you know, aspects, but then what about ROI? You know, so what about the bottom line? Is that really pay dividends for them so much because their audience is that way?
Absolutely. Without question, to use Patagonia as a specific example, does that work for everyone? No, not necessarily. But I think it's worked for them because they've done it in such an authentic way. They have data that supports that every time they lean into their social impact messaging, their ROI and their sales go up. They did a campaign that's really famous. I believe it was called Don't Buy This Sweater, or Don't Buy This Jacket. That was an Earth Day campaign, if memory serves me, which is the exact opposite of what a traditional apparel campaign would be. Mm. It may have been to introduce their Wornwear program if memory serves, which is a program that Patagonia has where you can take any Patagonia item that you've owned and they will repair it for free as long as they can. So in an interesting way, and you know, I think Patagonia is always thought of as this poster child. I believe that they've deserved that to a degree. There's still room for criticism about Patagonia, of course, but
really, they've what kind done, of criticism? Aren't they? What are they worth? Like 2 billion? What do they make a year? Like 3-4 billion? They're like massive, right? Can you tell us what they make per year?
I don't know. I don't know what their revenue
Yeti,
is.
But Yeti it's makes very 1.75 billion or around there, right? They're smaller than Patagonia, I think.
Yeah. So Patagonia, you know, the criticism, and this starts to get into like ethics around how our entire social structure and capitalism is set up in the US, but there's criticism around philanthropy in general and how corporations like Patagonia, even Patagonia being, let's say, objectively way less quote unquote evil than a standard mega corporation, they still have a lot of power and influence with all of that wealth that they've generated. And the founder has recently come out and set up a philanthropy of his own that basically, instead of taking all of the profit from Patagonia and, you know, leaving that wealth as personal wealth, he's creating a foundation in order to fund a lot of ecological climate action nonprofits and organizations, which is great, but it's also a huge tax advantage for him because he's able to maintain control through his family and allow those funds to essentially not have to be taxed as income. And that's true for philanthropy in general. And
but isn't that true that it's still, they're still getting taxed on it, but it's 60% or as opposed to 100% because of the right, because they're at whatever bracket, you know, that corporation's in.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not a tax
attorney. To their company's credit.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I'm not a tax attorney. I don't know all the ins and outs of how this works. There are very real benefits to philanthropy from a tax advantage, from a tax standpoint, which is, and you know, you can argue from both sides of this fence, right? In one hand, like a lot of really good work has happened because major foundations and familial wealth has been put towards good causes. On the other hand, folks can argue, well, if that money had been taxed, it would go to the government. The government would be putting that into social programs, and it's more democratic because we can vote on, you know, how decisions get made in government. In theory, doesn't seem to really work so well in practice these days.
I bring it up because I like Patagonia. I think they're like a benchmark. They're somebody to look at, and you know, as far as a great story as a company, you know, so that, you know, I'd like to find out, like, you know, in the weeds, you know, like what's it like working with that kind of company? How do you offer them campaigns that are going to like produce, you know, great results, you know? And what are some tricks that, let's say, Patagonia does, because they're a great example, you know, great American product, right? They're an American company, right?
They are an American company. I don't think all of their labor happens in America. But they're an American company.
Yeah.
And just to be clear, I also love Patagonia. I'm not here to trash Patagonia.
They're your client, right?
No, we don't have Patagonia as a client.
So why do you bring it? What was the
correlation? I think they just came up in the conversation as a kind of commonly cited example of a successful social enterprise. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about somebody you work with, you know.
Sure.
You know, when you, let's say you have any outdoor companies, for example.
We haven't recently done anything outdoor. Let me bring up another example of a nonprofit we've recently worked with. So this is top of mind for me. So we have a client, Stem from Dance. They're based out of New York City. They're expanding their programs outside of New York, but they have essentially a curriculum for young girls to introduce them into STEM fundamentals, STEM being a science, technology. I can't remember what the E stands for in math. Can you help me out with E?
No.
it's a common thing. See, I'm not an academic, but
is it stem cell research of some sort?
No, it's just an acronym in kind of academia that stands for some of the kind of like core fundamental skills of, you know, these different disciplines. So it's typically the kind of knowledge and education that can lead to really good sustainable careers after school, right? So it's something that like in high school and especially, and even younger, like really a lot of curriculum is focused on STEM And I think there's also STEAM. They added the A. I don't know what the A stands for either. It's been a while since I've been in school. But basically, this program exists to really introduce, not that I love this term, but it's what folks are using, like underserved populations into STEM. And the way that they're doing it is really interesting. Their approach is to do that through dance-focused programs. So the way that actually shows up is girls, you know, enter these programs. They have summer programs and others, and they learn how to code and they learn how to create these performances that are part dance and part technology. So they have glowing lights, they have projections. Really cool, right? A great way to get someone interested in STEM-based curriculum that otherwise might be really boring and dry and like not very enticing for, you know, a high school age girl to want to get into in a summer program, right? So they're an example of a client we've helped. And,
I want to know how, like, what are the mechanics? How do you get it out there? They create content. How do you promote the content? How do you bring a consciousness and awareness of that company? Because I understand now, you know, how they're, you know, everybody can, you know, formulate their campaign, but how do you help them with getting it out there and to the right, you know, audience? And how is that doled out?
Yeah, exactly. You're on target. So one of the things that we kind of base a lot of our work on is this kind of point of view or this philosophy of the attention economy, which is a term we didn't make, but that have you heard that term before?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So basically, for listeners who may not be familiar with that, I'll try and summarize briefly. So as technology has allowed most of us to have more and more access to free and flowing information, it's really hard to capture, sustain, and get our attention as people, right? I mean, we all experience this with our social feeds overflowing, our inboxes overflowing. We're becoming less and less attentive and able to focus. And so for social impact organizations, but any organization really, the name of the game is how can you capture people's attention and how can you sustain that attention to drive action, right? So if you're a traditional company, how do you get people's attention to buy stuff or, you know, buy your product or watch your TV show that you just produced or whatever? For social impact organizations, they have to play within the attention economy the same way that everyone else does. And oftentimes on much, much, much tinier budgets than, you know, Netflix or Apple or Patagonia even. And so we really try to think about our work and how design and technology can be tools that are applied to social impact more broadly, but even more specifically to this attention economy that we're in a way to help kind of cut through and break through the noise. And so what does that look like? You know, it's different for different organizations, but it starts by accepting that kind of truth, that that's the world we're in, which we all kind of intuitively know, but maybe we don't think about every day when you're out there, you know, running a nonprofit or running a business. You said the word content, which is a huge, important part of that, right? This podcast that we're recording right now is a piece of content. And the way that we communicate today is through digital channels and through content, articles, whether that's an article, a podcast, you know, through TikTok or a post on Instagram. You know, we still talk to each other in person, right? But so much of our information, probably more and most of our information, we get through social channels and through digital channels. So we help our clients figure out, understanding that, and from that point of view, what are the opportunities to create a sustainable communications strategy, which is built on, you know, a strong brand, a clear impact story and messaging that kind of supports that, understanding who their audience is so that we can create content and stories and messages that capture their attention and activate them to volunteer, to donate, to spread the word, whatever the actions are, to sign petitions, to influence policymakers sometimes, to buy products if you're a social enterprise. And so really, that's kind of how we, from a brand strategy standpoint, approach our work. And then tactically, you know, what does that look like? Building brands, building websites, coming up with marketing strategies, helping them figure out what content opportunities are there. Can they do a podcast? Can they release videos? Can they produce articles to communicate their impact, to educate their audience, and to ultimately inspire action?
How much of it is repetition now? I also hear, you know, as far as, and I don't think there's any difference between going viral on TikTok and going viral with a product. And that is, here's the lane, here's the modality, how we do it. Try to give as much value for that. stay consistent with that and repeat, 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 make slight adjustments, you know, but don't be discursive or peripatetic. That's a fancy word. Or, you know, like, you know, being ADHD, you know, in your campaign, you know, is that part of the algorithm that to really get, you know, and then hopefully you work really hard to put yourself in a fortuitous situation where there's like a hydro flask kind of visco girl kind of thing that pops up? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I think you're spot on. It's definitely really difficult to strike the right balance of experimentation, trying new channels, trying new formats, and consistency and longevity, right? There's something about, you know, you do a podcast, you know, this having a regular schedule, putting stuff out, you know, on time. People want to know I'm going to get this podcast or this article once a week or twice a week or once a month. It can be hard, especially when you're looking at engagement ROI on some of those things, to know how long should I wait before I make a choice as to whether or not this is working or not. What we've seen is that there is no silver bullet that works for every organization. It really requires figuring out what your special sauce is. And for some organizations, that's video, and video works really well for them. For other organizations, that's long form copy and email still, which seem like these archaic ways of communicating. But, you know, all of us still read a lot of articles. Even young folks who are mostly on TikTok are still reading articles. They still usually have an email. That's changing a little bit, but it really depends. If you're a social impact organization that's mostly trying to reach policymakers, you might not care about TikTok at all, and that's okay. So I think the kind of fallacy is to say we must be on everything. We must have TikTok and Instagram and Twitter and YouTube and email and all of those things, and then you just don't do any of that super well. And so I think early on, if you're thinking about trying to create a new, let's just call it a marketing strategy, a communication strategy, you do want to go in and always want to go in with a sense of curiosity and experimentation, iteration, and not just doing things the way they've been done, because that's how you've always done it. At the same time, ultimately, what you want to work towards is figuring out what format works best for you, what cadence works best for you. And once you start to kind of understand that, then you can kind of double down on those things and maybe shed some stuff that's not quite as effective.
Do you, when you talk to, let's say B2C, because it's a little bit different, you know, possibly a nonprofit to B2B or whatever, you know, as well. But when you talk to, let's say B2C, and, you know, in the old days, it'd be like, well, you got to make sure you don't say this and be very structured in this, as to where now it's almost like a thumbprint where it's like we got to find out what your thumbprint is to really kind of get your, because there's so much information, there's so many companies, there's so much, you know, no one can copy you. So we got to dig deep on, I mean, is that what you guys do sometimes? So like dig deep and say, who owns a company or what's your message? You know, not just your message, but like you're nodding. Yeah. So am I close to, how does that work?
Yeah. I think that's another really important thing is that as an organization, whether you're a business or a nonprofit or whatever, really trying to like get clear on what are your unique strengths as an organization? Like, what can you do that no one else can really do to the same degree? I think it's especially important in social impact because what tends to happen is an organization gets started for whatever reason, because, you know, maybe their founder or their executive director or their CEO has some kind of background or experience or expertise around an issue area. And then as they start to do that work, they start to see how the work that they're doing intersects with the entire system that's creating that issue in the first place. And a common example would be like homelessness. So let's say an organization gets started at a shelter that opens up, you know, 100 beds in a community, and they're constantly doing this relief work and helping, you know, folks on the street, you know, providing them with housing and with shelter. But then they're like, wait, why is there homelessness in the first place? And they start like looking around at all the different factors. And I think that's a good intuition. But then all of a sudden it's like, wait, are you trying to be a relief organization? Are you trying to do stuff that creates new policies and new, let's call them levers that prevent homelessness from happening in the first place? So what does that look like? Economic stability, education, healthcare, right? All the things that make society effective and equitable. it's really hard to do both. Some organizations can, some organizations really should maybe just focus on let's call it the relief side, where they just really want to get that shelter working as good as possible, educating the community, spreading awareness around how, you know, folks can find out about the shelter. And maybe another organization really needs to focus on creating new systems and new approaches to prevent homelessness in the first place. Now, that's just one example, right? But what tends to happen is what we would call essentially mission creep. You start to see how it all fits together and you're like, wait, we need to fix that part too. And that part too, because that's leading to this. And then all of a sudden you're trying to do too many things and you kind of, well, what's the difference between your organization and some other organization doing kind of similar work? So like really leaning into, okay, based on our unique strengths, our staff, our founding story, even like, what do we have to offer in a way that no one else is doing? And like really doubling down on that. In the business world, you know, this is essentially positioning and differentiation. Like, how is your approach or your product different and better than, you know, XYZ product that's doing something similar? So we encourage organizations to kind of think about things from that perspective, double down again on what's where their unique strengths are, and then partnering with other organizations that are better at the part that's also really important, but maybe they're better served to do.
You know, off the subject, I'm like sitting here listening to you. I'm wondering how many clients you got to talk to sometimes. And, you know, to me, if I was in your shoes, I'd be like, I like to hear a company that says, you know, we're just trying to do this just to kind of like improve this situation, a microcosm of the situation, you know, take off chunks that are realistic to tackle. But then you got to sit with the client says, we're trying to change the world. And I was like, you know, I mean, how many times have you heard that phrase? I'm just curious.
Less than you would think.
Okay, good.
I think when you're in, you know, it's funny, as I heard that a lot more when we were doing work with startups in Silicon Valley than when we were doing actual social impact work, right. Which is, if you've never seen the show Silicon Valley, you should definitely watch it.
Especially, I've seen some episodes, yeah.
Yeah. I think folks in this sector are pretty aware of this issue. It's been discussed. I still think it's an easy trap to fall into. And I would say that like we definitely enjoy working with folks who are more pragmatic and are like, hey, you know, we're a regionally focused organization. We help this community in this way. We know we're never going to solve the entire problem. But I mean, one of the things is like, again, to go back to homelessness, yes, there are systemic political, cultural issues that we need to fix if we're ever going to end homelessness. In the meantime, we still need shelters. We can't shut all the shelters down while we figure out how to fix that in the next 5, 10, 20, 100 years, right? So there's we like to think about it like an ecosystem and finding your niche within that ecosystem. And for a thriving ecosystem to happen, we need all kinds of diversity of types of organizations. We need those direct relief organizations. And we need the think tanks and the policymakers who are thinking about how to prevent the issue from happening in the first place. And they need to work together so that the think tanks are learning from the people who are seeing the issue firsthand, doing boots on the ground work.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of the that there are things that are doable and they happen sometimes in small doses. New York City in the 70s had like a garbage problem. And then, you know, they cleaned it up. I don't know the methodologies or whatever, but you say, well, they cleaned it up. You still could walk down the street and somebody's taking a crap on right there in the middle of the street now. Because you've actually heard somebody say that, you know, in Manhattan. But, you know, compared to the 70s, the town was very dirty. So, you know, being from LA, you know, I'm wondering, you know, is LA going to be doing that? What kind of companies are going to come along that maybe can, you know, help that a little bit? You know, and when I think of these nonprofits that you work with and the kind of campaigns that you're doing, you know, it's like, well, you know, this is, we could, you know, let's hope for maybe this part of it. And that's a win off subject. So where are you at? I'm just curious, you know, are you career wise, you know, people that are listening, you know, as far as the way this business works, where are you at right now with your company, you know, as far as, you know, clients and, you know, the growth of your company? And then I like to get into like, you know, future, but where are you at right now? You know, what's happening topical.
Yeah. I feel like we're in a really good place right now in the sense that as we've been growing, we started being very regionally focused in the sense that, you know, we started the company in Santa Cruz. We had a really strong network in Santa Cruz in the Bay Area and generally just kind of California. Like we had decent brand awareness. at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, we had a studio downtown, an office. Once we kind of saw the writing on the wall, we're like, okay, this is going to be, this isn't going away in a month. Like maybe we were hoping at first. And we'd already been kind of toying around with, hey, what if we went remote and kind of, you know, didn't have such a central headquarters and really tried to, we'd done work with clients outside of California many times, outside of the US even. But if you looked at our roster of clients, it was very heavily Bay Area and California focused. And so it was a time that really, I think for a lot of people, this is true, but for us, it was true. It forced us to kind of reinvent the model to a degree. And it was an opportunity for us to really be forced to and step up to breaking out of our regional pigeonhole that we were in. And so that's been our journey since, you know, 2020, basically. And it's been really awesome, really rewarding, really challenging. But ultimately, I feel like we're not done with that transition, but we're in a place where most of our work is coming from our own marketing and outside of California. A lot of it still, because always personal networks and referrals from past clients are a strong source of our work, as it should be, because that's, I think, just a sign we're doing good work and we have happy clients. But it feels much more sustainable in that we're able to generate new business and leads and good connections with right fit organizations that we can learn from and that kind of really challenge us as creatives and really allow us to make a bigger impact. Because as an organization, we only make an impact through helping our clients make a bigger impact in their own work, right? That's because we're designers. We're not out there doing research, doing policy, doing activism ourselves. We're just helping organizations who are doing that work become more effective and scale their impact through design and technology. So for us, our goal is to attract better and better fit clients that we can really A, believe in the work they're doing as people, as humans, and be motivated emotionally and, you know, creatively to do that work. And also to just really have opportunities to help organizations that have potential to make really big impact. That's really our goal. And I see us really starting to get some traction there in a way that's just really cool to see and makes the day-to-day work that can be really hard just so much more worth it.
What about you? What's your long-term 5, 10, 15-year goal? Do you go that far out? Do you have any long-term? Do you want to exit? You know, they say every business should have an exit. You know, do you say, no, I want to, yeah, I'm going to sell the business one day and I'm going to teach surfing down, you know, and, you know, down south again. I don't know. You know, what's on your radar?
My current radar is very hyper-focused on having a second kid in about a month. Right. So that's been my focus, and, which is great. Beyond that, though, I've been working really hard from the beginning and especially in the last few years to figure out, like, how can we create a business that is sustainable, not just like economically, and because we don't do like physical products, like we don't really have to worry too much about environmental impact of our business, although going remote does even help with that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just like the experience of working at Cosmic, for me as the founder and the creative director, I'm still very involved in the client work. I'm not like a silent partner or anything. We're nine people. Like, how could we be, right? But also like for the team. So how have we done that? You know, traditionally agencies are pretty awful places to work, frankly. People work really hard, really long hours, 60, 80 hour work weeks, not uncommon at all. Working 14 hour days for pitches, not a great place to be long-term unless you're just like really getting started and like you can pour your, basically your entire life into that. A lot of folks are doing that for stuff that they don't even really believe in, but it becomes a status thing. It becomes an ego thing for a lot of people. I don't mean this to be a critical thing. I'm not trying to say, you know, I'm holier than thou, but I just knew that's not how I wanted to run things. Even just for myself. And I think at some level, I kind of thought about, what do I want my experience to be? And why wouldn't I expect other people working with me to want that same thing? So working reasonable hours, having true work-life balance, working on stuff that they care about, they can get behind, that's not soul-sucking, that's not going against their ethics or their morals. So I've been really focused, kind of putting my founder hat on, trying to figure out how to just create the best possible work experience for our team that allows us to grow as people, because I don't want to make a 50-100 person agency. Personally, I just don't want to have to manage that. It's not I kind of fell into this. I didn't expect to ever even be 9 people. Mm-hmm. I'm really thankful that this has allowed me to have a sustainable life in doing this and a sustainable business. But some people, when they think growth and their strategies around growth, their headcount and revenue. And for me, it's really more about lifestyle, honestly, for me and for my team. And so, you know, we do a few things. We pay as much as we possibly can. We're always trying to pay more, but we pay, you know, generally good wages for a company our size, even having folks in really expensive cost of living areas. We have a 4-day work week. So we work 4 8-hour days. We have all Fridays off. I'm here business casual, right? Just kind of taking a little break for this podcast, which is, you know, I don't even consider work, honestly, because I just have fun with them. But the team is off on Fridays. You know, certainly if there's some kind of client emergency, we'll phone in and help out. There's really not too many design emergencies, though, I've learned over the years. And so that's really been my focus around growth. It's like, how can we make a bigger impact, challenge ourselves so we're all growing creatively as people, doing better work for our clients in a way that's more sustainable, and creating an experience that leads to long-term sustainability instead of just like burnout culture, which is really something that happens a lot in the agency world. And from a straight business sense, it makes no sense to burn your people out and constantly be hiring new folks. It's really costly and stressful for especially me as a founder to have to do that. So we've really tried to figure out how can we find people who culturally fit that and prioritize that, maybe even above status or fame or money or whatever, but care about the work that we're doing and want to be part of a team that really kind of values people and allows them to live a balanced life.
Well, it sounds healthy. It's a very exciting time for you. You got a second one coming on. That's going to be a nice adventure. And I really, you know, thank you for sharing it. Please tell everybody how they could find out more about your service.
So the website is the place to go, designbycosmic.com. We publish a bunch of free resources there on the insights tab. So check that out, you know, articles, white papers, the standard stuff, especially for organizations that, you know, want to do this work, maybe can't budget for it or need to, you know, be able to fundraise for it to get them started, to get them learning and even self-experimenting for a while. So definitely recommend that. Of course, you can see examples of all our work and all the standard stuff there as well. We do a bunch of podcasts like this too. We publish those on the insights tab, so you can find them there. So really, designbycosmic.com is the place to go. And I also welcome anyone to reach out to me directly. My email is eric@designbycosmic.com.
Good conversation out of the beginning of the year. It's part of our series, you know, doing, you know, health and advertising your business and launching a business and all that. I think this is, you know, perfect for this time of year. So thank you for sharing, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
That was the founder of Cosmic, the social impact creative agency, Eric Ressler. And I got a good quote for him too. The aim of marketing is to know and understand the customer so well the product or service fits him and sells itself. Peter F. Drucker. Thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hanging out with you all on the next episode. All right. Have you guys been to longshotleaders.com? That's where you can check out all of the guests and the bios and the backgrounds and more. Also, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to the podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we do, give us a good rating. Tell your family and friends to come by and listen. It's going to make you feel nice and toasty inside. Every week, we'll be delivering knowledge, creativity, inspiration, exasperation, perspiration. If it ends with a shun, basically, you're going to find it here. All right. Thank you for joining us. And in the great words of Bill Murray in the movie Caddyshack, friends for life, I say.